We continue on in our series of lectures that provide the historical backdrop to the Westminster Assembly. Today, I'm going to deal with the members of the Westminster Assembly and how they got there. That's basically what I'm going to cover today. So, here we go. On 12 June 1643, the English Parliament passed an act entitled, now catch this, this is what its title is, An Ordinance of the Lords and Commons in Parliament for the calling of an assembly of divines and others to be consulted with by the Parliament for the settling of the government and liturgy of the Church of England and clearing the doctrine of said church from false aspersions and interpretations. Take a breath. That's just part of the title. The very fact that the assembly was called by the Parliament and was mandated to consult with Parliament tells us this body is not an ecclesiastical synod or church court. Rather, it is a deliberative and consultative body. The final sentence of this ordinance explains it further, quote, provided always that this ordinance or anything therein contained shall not give unto it the persons aforesaid any of them, nor shall they in this assembly assume to exercise any jurisdiction, power, or authority, ecclesiastical whatsoever, or any other power than is herein particularly expressed. Okay, what they're saying is anybody who's a member of this assembly is not exercising church power, period. They are consultants about theology. Now, the fact that the Parliament would call such a body together has rubbed some contemporary Presbyterians the wrong way because they question the legitimacy of such a body of theologians or divines who are called by the state. To them, in our current church-state situation, that sounds like a confusion of church and state. William Symington, the great 19th century Scottish Presbyterian Covenanter, says, but wait a second, the Westminster Confession itself, chapter 23.3, would allow such complementary working of church and state together. Article 3 of 23 says, the civil magistrate has authority, and it is his duty to take order, that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed, for the better effecting whereof he has power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. So, in our own tradition, we've been basically been able to accommodate the idea that there's a complementary interaction between church and state. You see this, for instance, in the canons of Dort. They were organized by the Estates General of Holland. The Heidelberg Catechism was commissioned by King Edward the Wise in Germany, or rather the Prince in the Palatinate of Germany. Various other documents had express sanction by the magistrate in our tradition. If you look back at the ecumenical councils, they were all called by the magistrate. So it's not a problem in our tradition, but I will grant that oftentimes in our contemporary situation in America of radical separation of church and state, this sounds very strange to our ears. But that's okay. It is fully legitimate for the church to be a preacher of righteousness to the state and for the state to have an interest in the religion in its country. And the Parliament had a tremendous interest in it because there was great turmoil in the land, in the country of England because of this lack of religious unity. Symington explains, it was called by the magistrate in a time when blasphemies, heresies, corruptions, and abuses in worship and discipline prevailed. And the point was to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the truth because this affected the welfare of the commonwealth. I'll tell you, this is not something we think about today, but it is true. The health of the church affects the health and the welfare of the state. It just is impossible to pretend that those things don't interact in some way that's meaningful and important to the stability and health and order of a society. So what I want to do this morning then is think about this body of people that was called by the Parliament for the purpose of advising them. I want to begin today by talking about the calling of the assembly, and we'll move through several points as quickly as we can. By the way, I will quote from several different people and use their works. One of them is a man named Spears. His name is Wayne Spears, or Dr. Spears. He was the longtime teacher of systematic theology at the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh. He is a living expert on the Westminster Assembly. He wrote his PhD dissertation on the Westminster Assembly, and it's absolutely highly credible academic work to this day. So I'll be using some of his stuff, and I'll also be using some stuff from Symington and Schaff and some others. But let's proceed now. Spears tells us that by ordinance of Parliament, the assembly was called to commence meeting Saturday, 1 July 1643. No sooner does Parliament extend this ordinance to call the assembly that King Charles I proclaims his decree that anybody participates in it will be denounced by the king, and they are threatened with fines and imprisonment. Now, this had a wonderful way of figuring out whose side a particular pastor was on theologically. Because if your pastor showed up at the assembly on Saturday, 1 July 1643, there's a very good chance that he wasn't on the side of the king. And if he didn't show up, the person that was called to be there didn't show up, it would be a good indication that he at least feared the king and perhaps also shared his theological views on Episcopalianism and some other matters. So the assembly was convened on July 1, 1643 with 69 members. They gathered together at the Abbey of Westminster. The proceedings were initiated by a sermon preached by Dr. William Twiss, who would become the chairman of the whole assembly. The sermon was on John 14:18, and it was entitled, "I will not leave you comfortless. I will come to you." Of course, you can see that Dr. Twiss would have applied that to the proceedings as they were surrounded with all of the anxiety and concern of the surrounding church and state situation in England. The delegates gathered for assembly at the chapel of Henry VII, and Schaff says the medieval architecture formed a striking contrast to the Puritan simplicity of worship and dress. Now he describes what the Puritans look like. I've included this just for your being able to sort of imagine the situation. The divines appeared in black coats or cloaks, skull caps, and Geneva bands. Those are white. They look like bow ties or white little strips of cloth that would have come down the front of their chest. And we're told by Schaff that they had long peaked beards and mustaches and broad double ruff around the neck, whatever that is. So you get the picture of these solemn-looking guys gathered together in a room, and their very look tipped off the fact that whatever they're doing was very serious. They began by taking a vow. Here is the vow, which was read every Monday morning for the rest of the 5 years and several months that they met. "I do seriously promise and vow in the presence of Almighty God that in this assembly whereof I am a member, I will maintain nothing in point of doctrine but what I believe to be most agreeable to the Word of God, nor in point of discipline but what may make most for God's glory and the peace and the good of His church." Well, after taking the oath, they disbanded until the following Thursday. From there on out, they began to meet Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. in the morning till 1 in the afternoon. Those are better than bankers' hours. They met in the King Henry VII's chapel until it got too cold, and then they moved over to the Abbey of Westminster in the Jerusalem Chamber. As they began their work, they took up the revision of the 39 Articles, which were the confessional standard of the Church of England, going all the way back to the days of King Edward VI. For almost 100 years, this had been the confessional standard in the churches. And for the most part, it was Calvinistic, but it had some problems with it. So the point of the assembly, this was the charge given by Parliament. They were to meet and revise the 39 Articles. And this they did furiously for 15 weeks. They got to Article 15. They were almost halfway through until these pesky people showed up called Scottish commissioners. That changed everything. Let me explain to you about the Scottish commissioners a moment. At the time the Parliament called this assembly, there was a civil war between Parliament and King Charles I. And depending on which day it is, you can figure out who had the upper hand. It was a tug-of-war battle between the two. Parliament wanted the help of the Scottish troops, and the king wanted the help of the Scottish troops. While Parliament was meeting, a commission of English theologians and ambassadors were sent to Scotland to secure the help of the Scottish. Two leading ministers, Stephen Marshall and Philip Nye, arrived in Scotland in Edinburgh on 7 August 1643. They were received well by the General Assembly, that is the Church of Scotland, and they appointed a committee to deal with them. And they had certain bonds that bound them together immediately. One, they had a great distaste for Arminian theology, which was beginning to pervade the churches of England and Scotland. Number two, they had a great distaste for high church Episcopalianism, which was the form of church government followed in England, and Charles was forcing it upon Scotland as well. They found the heavy-handed rule of the bishops more than unbearable and distasteful. And they had a healthy fear of Charles I. So they had things in common which would have made them receptive to the English. But there was this one matter of concern for the Scots. The Scots wanted a uniformity of religion because they believed that's what Scripture taught. So they arrived at an agreement which is entitled the Solemn League and Covenant. It had political as well as spiritual dimensions. As far as the political dimensions, the Solemn League pledged preservation of the rights and privileges of parliaments, as well as the king's person and authority. And in terms of religious application, it was designed to extirpate, that is, get rid of, popery and prelacy. It also gave indications where the work of the Westminster Assembly would be directed. Listen to this. Two, the preservation of the Reformed religion in the Church of Scotland in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government against our common enemies, the reformation of religion in the kingdoms of England and Ireland in doctrine, worship, discipline, and government according to the Word of God and the example of the best Reformed churches. And we shall endeavor to bring the churches of God in the three kingdoms to the nearest conjunction and uniformity in religion, confession of faith, of church government, directory for worship, and catechizing, that we and our posterity after us may, as brethren, live in faith and love, and the Lord may delight to dwell in the midst of us. Now that is a huge agenda. Think about it. The Scots are saying, we will give you soldiers, and you will agree to nothing less than drawing up a confession of faith that's thoroughly reformed and covers issues such as worship and church government and catechizing, because we want this whole doctrinal settlement to be passed on from one generation to the next, because they believe that the Lord's blessing upon the kingdom, Scotland, England, and Ireland, was directly tied to their faithfulness and devotion to the Lord in doctrine, worship, and government. So this is very important. This is what they set out to do. Now, this is why it changed all the proceedings at Westminster, at the Assembly. Because they were just dilly-dallying around with the 39 Articles. And the fact of the matter is, the Scots said, if you want our soldiers to beat down Charles I for you, you're going to have a very thorough Reformed faith. Not just one you could print on the backside of a dime. Now, I'm not suggesting the 39 Articles was that meager, but certainly the Westminster standards are much more thoroughgoing and systematic. That's what was wanted. So Scotland said, yes, we will give you our troops, and you will take five of our best theologians to help oversee the whole process so that we can ensure that whatever is produced produces unity of doctrine, worship, government, and catechizing. So this changed everything. 12 October 1643, the Assembly was directed by Parliament to work on preparing a directory of government, worship, and discipline. Now, let's think about why this was going to be difficult. And we will find why this was going to be difficult when we think about the various parties, the factions, if you will, that would be present at the assembly. I'm going to give you five different groups, even though there are strictly speaking four, but you have to count the Scottish Presbyterians as their own group. They are the theological muscle, if you will, of the assembly. First of all, there's Episcopalians. There were four bishops there, at least who were appointed to the assembly. James Usher, who was a towering theologian, towering, enormous. Then you have Bishop Brownig, who was Bishop of Exeter, Westville, Bishop of Bristol, and Purdue, Bishop of Worcester. They had five doctors of divinity among them, including those of Dr. Hammond. And they appointed other pastors to also attend the meeting. So there was not a lot of Episcopalians there, but the ones who were there, they were loaded. They were strong, stalwart, theologically sharp and savvy men. The only problem was that no one was interested in Episcopalianism anymore. You could have appointed the brightest Episcopalian theologians in the world, and they probably had them there. They weren't going to be received well. Why? Well, because Charles I and his Archbishop Laud had done enough damage with their very distasteful, heavy-handed rule through bishops in England that no one liked them anymore. Here's why. Parliament passed a bill called from the Root and Branch Party, and it was signed by 15,000 citizens of London that demanded the total overthrow of episcopal hierarchy. In other words, they wanted to eliminate hierarchy in church government entirely. It was decreed out of existence by a bill of parliament, finally, 5 November 1643, that utterly abolished all archbishops, bishops, chancellors, and so forth. So, as the assembly is meeting, Parliament passes a bill which sends the death knell into Episcopalianism. But I have to mention them. Secondly, there are Erastians. Erastians. They are so named after a physician whose name was Thomas Erastus. He was Swiss. He was a professor. And his views on church government were very widespread on the continent. Basically, Bullinger and Beza thoroughly opposed him, but many accepted Erastianism. Erastianism is basically this. The civil government runs the church, period. The power of the keys, discipline that is, belongs to the secular magistrate. There were no officers in the church. There were only teachers who taught. And that means that if you were a pastor, you showed up at the local county court's office to pick up your paycheck on Friday. You didn't get it from the church. So they ran everything in the church except the appointed teachers to teach. And the people who are at the assembly who were Erastian were formidable. Selden, Lightfoot, and Coleman were intellectual dynamite. They were high-powered academians. And when they spoke and what they wrote was strong. The chief books were written by Selden. It's called De Synedris and Lightfoot's Journal. And on the Presbyterian side, they were opposed by Gillespie with his Aaron's Rod Blossoming and Rutherford's Divine Right of Church Government. Symington says the Erastians were few in number, but by no means contemptible in point of talent or learning. Generally speaking, they were greatly skilled in Oriental literature, and they made great use of that as they refuted the Presbyterian view. Thirdly, there was a group called Independents. Independents. There are only five of them. They are called Dissenting Brothers. They consisted of Thomas Goodwin, Philip Nye, Jeremiah Burroughs, William Bridge, and Sidrack Simpson. They were also invited theologians from the New England colonies, but they rejected because they said, number one, it's a long way away, and number two, we might have to live with what the confession decides on. We don't want to have to do that. So they stayed in England, or rather in New England. The Scottish, well, they didn't like the independents so much. Robert Bailey, one of the Scottish commissioners who kept a very thorough and detailed journal of all the proceedings of the Westminster Assembly, at least for a few years, said this of them. Liberty of conscience and toleration of all or any religion, as advocated by some of their men, be so prodigious an impiety that the Independents maintained that a Christian congregation should consist of converted believers and govern itself according to Christ's laws. And of course, these were things they were absolutely, as Presbyterians, unwilling to allow. Presbyterians in the 17th century do not agree that there should be such thing as religious toleration. Presbyterians believe everybody should be Presbyterians. Why? Because they believe Presbyterianism is from the Bible, period. There's no other way to look at it for a Presbyterian. Your doctrine, your worship, your church government, everything is chapter and book and verse from the Bible. If it's not, it's not Presbyterian. So you can see from the start that Presbyterians are not going to be good at negotiating. They'll be good at debating, but they're not good at negotiating. They can't give up the Bible. They have to stand firm. And so this is going to be a very difficult assembly, because you have the Erastians and you have the Independents who don't, who have their own opinions, and they're going to lock horns a lot. So now we have the Presbyterians. You have Presbyterianism taking root in England from the 1560s, 1570s. We've talked about this before. Thomas Cartwright was a professor of theology at Cambridge, and he began lecturing through the Book of Acts, I believe it was late 1560s, 58, 1699, something like that. And he clearly teaches a form of Presbyterianism, that there should be elders in the church and deacons, and the church should be ruled by local elders, and there should be a hierarchy of courts, a Presbyterian synod and general assembly and so forth. He's teaching this in England. It was pretty sharply opposed, yet they had a sort of functional church within the church, sort of Presbyterian government in the 15, all the way up through the 1580s, operating in England, that included as many as we're told as maybe 500 pastors who held to it. So fairly widespread. But the view was beaten down, let's say, by the episcopacy and the royal crown. And they had so much say and authority that they were easily able to snuff it out. But the ideas were hanging around, and so by the time you hit the Westminster Assembly, there are British or English theologians and pastors who hold to it, but you're going to find that within the group of Presbyterians at the Assembly, there's two classes. There are hardcore Presbyterians, which you would call high Presbyterians. They are the Scottish type of the school of Andrew Melville, who we looked at a couple of weeks ago, who believe in divine right Presbyterianism. In other words, we are Presbyterians because the Bible says so. Okay? And there are some British or English theologians who hold that, such as Stephen Marshall, Edwin Calamy, and so forth. They're called Smectamunians. It's a weird word, but that's what they're called. And they believe in divine right Presbyterian. Now, there's others who are human law Presbyterians. In other words, they say, well, it looks pretty good. You can make a good case from the Bible. But, you know, let's not say everybody else is wrong in so many words. I think that's a good way of saying this is their view. You could have ruled by bishops, but this is good too, and it'll work. So you have enough of these kind of people that Presbyterianism wins the day for now. Such that by June 29, 1647, all the parishes, by act of parliament within England, Wales, and Scotland, were to be brought under the government of congregational, classical, provincial, and national churches, according to the Presbyterian government agreed upon by the Westminster Assembly. So, Presbyterianism has its heyday in England and Scotland and Ireland in the 1640s and dies. A spectacular, dramatic, immediate death in 1650s. By who? By the hands of Cromwell, who was a Calvinist and an Independent. You can see these groups are going to oppose each other. They're going to clash. And Presbyterianism all but dies in England. And it lives on in Scotland, but in a muted form. Mutated form. Because you have the Scottish Covenanters who are going to carry on divine right Presbyterianism, and then you have the other Covenanter, the other Presbyterians of Scotland, who are going to agree to be Presbyterian because the king said we could be. That's human law Presbyterianism, and it's very different. So, you finally come to the Scottish Commissioners. And there's a lot to say about the Scottish Commissioners. Let me just say this. This is from Symington. He says, the extensive knowledge, the studious habits, the promptitude and ease in graphic composition of Bailey, the mental power, the logical precision, the affectionate earnestness, and the lofty devotional feeling of Rutherford, the calm dignity, the intellectual might, the prodigious wisdom, the true moral greatness of Henderson, and the untiring energy, the comprehensive learning, the controversial tact, and the brilliant eloquence of young Gillespie conspired to render the commissioners from Scotland the admiration of the assembly and to reflect the highest honor on the country and the church to which it belongs. Cheering for the Presbyterians from Scotland by a Presbyterian from Scotland. It's great. That's a good summary, though. The men of Scotland were no doubt towering intellects. God raised up just some very, very gifted men in Scotland in these commissioners. Rutherford and Gillespie, just Bailey, Henderson, just extremely, extremely devout men, uncompromising, but thoroughly biblical, and had just tremendous abilities. Now, that brings us to the actual divines of the assembly. And we'll just go through this, and then we'll be able to conclude today. The divines of the assembly. Let's think about their method of selection. The House of Commons passed a bill designating how the divines would be selected for participation in the Westminster Assembly. We're told in this bill that the knights and burgesses of every English county shall bring the names of two divines, and every Welsh county one. So the Welsh didn't get as much influence. From each university, two were to be selected, and from the City of London, four. And they were to be consulted with concerning the government discipline and public liturgy of the church. So you can see here that Parliament does not trust the church to select the divines. The divines will be selected by the Parliament. That indicates this is a parliamentary body of people. They are there to serve Parliament, and so the Parliament selects people who will suit their tastes. Also, they added 30 what are called lay members, or non-divines, or non-preachers, or non-pastors to the assembly. Parliament would select those as well. And Schaff provides us with a pithy quote from a man named Selden, who you will remember was an Erastian, who gives a tongue-in-cheek rationale for why the Parliament added its own members to the assembly. He said, "There must be some laymen in the synod to overlook the clergy, lest they spoil the civil work. Just as when the good woman puts a cat into the milk house to kill a mouse, she sends her maid to look after the cat, lest the cat eat up all the cream." Okay, so we learn about this, that none of the clergy were from royal or noble families. We also learn from a man named Murphy that 87% of the divines had at least a Bachelor of Arts degree, 85% had a Master of Arts degree, 37% had a Bachelor of Divinity degree, which required 7 years of study beyond a Master of Arts. And they had the ability to preach in Latin. They also had 25% of divines had a Doctor of Divinity. And the Doctor of Divinity represented 4 years of study beyond the already 7 years that it took to get the Bachelor of Divinity, which was beyond the Master. So altogether, if you had a Doctor of Divinity, you had studied 11 years more past receiving your Master of Arts. That is ridiculous. I mean, that means you would have to be in school at least until your early 30s to have a Doctor of Divinity. That's if you went straight through and you didn't stop. That is an amazing amount of education. 25% of the divines had that kind of training. Now, let's just look at some of the divines. I'm going to use here biographical sketches from Dr. Schaff. There's a lot of places you can go for this. There are 120 divines. I'm not going to read through all of them. I'm just going to read through the ones who had quite a bit of say about the assembly and the outcome. So just kind of listen and enjoy it, because you wouldn't read it probably for yourself. But I'm going to read it here just so you get a sense of the kind of caliber of people who were sitting at the assembly and making the decisions and drawing up the documents. You have Dr. William Twiss. rector of Newbury. He was the moderator of the assembly until he died in 1646. He was of German descent. When the assembly began, he was 69 years of age. He was noted as a superlapsarian, full of learning and speculative genius. But, as Bailey says, he was merely bookish, and he was ill-fitted to be the moderator of the assembly. Dr. Owen says of him, though he didn't agree with some of the things he said, that he was the veteran leader, so well trained in the scholastic field, this great man, the very learned and illustrious Twiss. McCrae describes him as a venerable man, verging on 70 years of age, with a long, pale countenance, an imposing beard, lofty brow, meditative eye, the whole contour indicating a life spent in severe and painful study. Whether it's anecdote or truth, we are told that the last words of Dr. Twiss were, "Now at length, I shall have leisure to follow my studies to all eternity." Charles Hurrell, an Oxford scholar, rector of Winnick in Lancashire, he succeeded Twiss as the moderator. He was a moderate Presbyterian. He wrote against independency in the book. In its preface, he said, "The difference between us is not so great. At most, it does not but ruffle a little the fringe, not anyway rend the garment of Christ." So you can see, remember I told you there's two kinds of Presbyterians. The one who holds to Presbyterians by human law and divine right. Because the people who hold to it by divine right, because Jesus said so, are not going to say that about independence. They're not going to say, "Oh, there's not that much difference between us." They're going to say, "Wrong. There's all the difference in the world between us, because we're right and they're wrong, and our views are from the Bible and theirs aren't." Then you have John White and Dr. Cornelius Burgess. They were men of high esteem. Burgess was the great-grandfather of the Wesleys on the maternal side. He was active and sharp and a valiant defender of Presbyterianism. There was Dr. Arrowsmith, who was the head of St. John's College, Cambridge, a man with a glass eye, having lost one by an arrow shot, a learned divine, an elegant Latinist. Dr. Tuckney, vice chancellor of the university, an inspiring teacher, and he is one of the chief composers of the Catechism. It is said that Dr. Tuckney composed the exposition of the Ten Commandments, the larger Catechism. So if you want anybody to blame for feeling guilty after you read the larger Catechism and its exposition of the law, it's Dr. Tuckney. Edmund Calamy, one of the four representatives of the London clergy. He was a popular preacher and leader of the Presbyterian Party. Joseph Carroll, he had an M.A. He was a moderate independent. Thomas Coleman, also nicknamed Rabbi Coleman for his profound Hebrew. However, he was not endeared to Dr. Robert Bailey of Scotland, who described him as a half-scholar and half-fool. Thomas Gadiger, Bachelor of Divinity, a devourer of books, esteemed for learning, piety, and sound doctrine. Thomas Goodwin, he was one of the two patriarchs of English independency, along with Philip Nye, vicar of Trinity Church, Cambridge. He became the founder of Congregational Church of London in 1640, and he was the president of Magdalen College in Oxford up until the restoration of 1660 when he resigned. He was a favorite minister of Oliver Cromwell. He's said to be eloquent, orthodox, exemplary in life. But, as McCrae says, he was tinctured with a shade of gloom and austerity. And he records for us a humorous story about one time somebody showed up at the college there of Oxford, and we're told that it was in the middle of the night, so Dr. Goodwin greeted him with a half a dozen nightcaps on his head and religious horror in his countenance, overawed and terrified an applicant for examination in Oxford by asking him in a deathly voice, "Are you prepared to die?" I guess the man didn't continue studying at Oxford. Dr. Joshua Hoyle, he was the only Irish divine of the assembly. He was a master of the Greek and the Latin fathers. Dr. John Lightfoot, the greatest rabbinical scholar of his age, his works today are still are worth consulting. He was just a prodigious intellect, but he was also an Erastian. And then there's Stephen Marshall, He was lecturer at St. Margaret's, Westminster, and Bailey says he was hands down the best preacher in England, a fearless leader in political strife, and he was a favorite in the assembly. He was nicknamed by his royalist enemies as the Geneva Bull, and the most factious of the rebellions and divines who sat at Westminster. And so he didn't endear himself to many, it sounds like. Philip Nye, he was, obviously we've said, an independent, and he had originally been on the side of the Presbyterians and then sort of switched. And so, you know, people got a bad taste in his mouth about that. Then there was Herbert Palmer. He was a little man with a childlike look, we're told. Very disgraceful, very graceful, not disgraceful, and accomplished. And he was a fluent orator in French as well as English, and model pastor. And he was a moderate Presbyterian. Dr. Edward Reynolds, the pride and glory of the Presbyterian party, we're told. Learned, eloquent, cautious, but lacking in backbone. He carried the wounds of the church in his heart and his bowels to the grave with him. Sir Francis Roos, he was not a divine, but he was a lay member of the parliament. He's probably best known to history for the so-called Roos Psalter, where he collected versifications of all 150 psalms, and this became the preferred metrical psalter of the Scottish and many Presbyterians around the world, well into the 19th century. Then there was Lazarus Seaman. He was one of the representatives of the London clergy. He was a skilled Orientalist, and it was reputed that he always carried around with him his Hebrew Bible without points. You have to understand that Hebrew Bibles come with points so that we know which vowels to put under the consonants, how to pronounce the word. So if a guy can walk around with vowel points in his Bible and still read and make sense of the text, that means he knows Hebrew very well. John Selden, one of the lay assessors who was appointed to the committee by Parliament. He was a scholar of wit and European reputation. He was a master of languages, law, and antiquities. We're told by Fuller, who seems to have been on his side, that he liked to correct the Presbyterians and their, quote, little English pocket Bibles from the Greek and Hebrew. Not especially fond of the flesh of Scripture, he cast the bones at them to break their teeth therewith. He was Erastian, and he hated the clergy, we're told. Richard Vines, who was an excellent preacher, powerful in debate, much respected in all accounts. And then Thomas Young, he was a Scotchman by birth, so you guessed it. He was part of the Smectymnuans, the Presbyterians, the hardcore Presbyterians in England. Now that brings us to the Scottish commissioners. The first one is Alexander Henderson. He was the rector of University of Edinburgh. He was 60 years old at the beginning of the assembly. He was steeped in the writings of Knox and Melville, and perhaps one of the most stalwart Presbyterians next to Knox and Melville as well. He was the author of the Solemn League and Covenant. And since he was unmarried, he was able to give himself entirely to the assembly while he was there. We're told that he was a man of eminent composure, comprehensiveness, and breadth. There's also Robert Bailey. He was professor of divinity, University of Glasgow. We're told he didn't speak much, but he was a regular attendant for the full 3 years that he was there, and a shrewd observer, and he was also known as the most pleasant of all the gossips. George Gillespie, a minister of Edinburgh, was 31 years of age when he entered the assembly. He was the youngest, yet the brightest star. He was the prince of debaters who, with the fire of youth, we're told, had the wisdom of age. He first attracted attention when he was 24 years old, when he published this work entitled A Dispute Against the English Popish Ceremonies Obtruded Upon the Church of Scotland, which helped him revolt, and the Church of Scotland revolt against the Episcopalian liturgy pushed on it by Archbishop Laud. He took a leading part in the debates of the assembly against Erastianism and independency, and according to Scotch tradition, he once made even the most learned man at the assembly, according to some elders, some observers, his name was Selden, an Erastian, he made Selden say, "That young man, by his single speech, has swept away the labors of 10 years of my life." Schaff says that due to his excessive ardor and the activity of his mind, it wore out his frame, and as soon as he returned to Scotland, he died. That means he did not live even to the end of his 30s. Then there was Samuel Rutherford, professor of divinity and principal of St. Mary's College in St. Andrews. He was one of the most fervid and popular preachers in Scotland, highly esteemed for his learning and his piety. The characteristics of his mind were clearness of intellect, warmth, earnestness of affection, loftiness, spirituality, and devotional feeling. His book, Lex Rex, is considered one of the best works on civil and religious liberty in English history. And, of course, we're told that his letters, his legendary letters, the life and letters of Samuel Rutherford, which were written while he was in jail, demonstrate just what a saint this man was and what tremendous pastoral skills he had, which were born out of his affection for the people who he served. Finally, let's just get to an assessment of these men. I'm going to give you two assessments and we'll conclude. Richard Baxter, who was not a member of the Westminster Assembly, but was quite familiar with its operations and the men who were there, said, "The divines there congregated were men of eminent learning, godliness, ministerial abilities, and fidelity. And being not worthy to be one of them myself, I may the more freely speak the truth, even in the face of malice and envy, that as far as I'm able to judge by the information of all history of that kind, and by any other evidence left us, the Christian world, since the days of the apostles, had never a synod of more excellent divines than this convened." The Westminster divines, according to Dr. Stoughton, had learning, scriptural, patristic, scholastic, and modern enough to spare. All solid, substantial, and ready for use. Moreover, in the perception and advocacy of what was most characteristic and fundamental in the gospel of Jesus Christ, they were as a body considerably in advance of the highest scholarship of, he said, his present day, which would be the 19th century. So, in the estimation of many people who were not even a part of the assembly, this was an extremely talented and gifted bunch of people gathered together to defend a Reformed doctrine, to formulate it, to summarize it in both doctrine, worship, government, and catechism. I'll conclude my lecture there, and next week we'll go on to talk about how the assembly went about its business, and we should be shortly on our way looking at Article 1. Any questions? Yes, sir.